everyone. This is Lana. Thanks for tuning in. Well, this show is something new and different. My guest is Singh, who's an Indian Sikh, but he's also alt-right. Yes, he's an Anglophilic Sikh, and he has a good sense of humor, too. We'll talk about the parallels between the alt-right movement and Sikhism, the problem of Islam in India, the truth about British imperialism, mass immigration into Euro countries, cheating Chinese, and how some Indians do use their left hand to wipe. We also get into the Aryan invasion theory and talk about the swastikas found all over India. It's a good one, so stick around for Singh up next. Singh, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lana.
Well, you were actually one of the first people that greeted me when I arrived at the NPI alt-right conference in DC, and you were smiling and kind and wearing a turban. I was like, this is interesting.
probably threw you off there.
But of course, you turned out to be a very cool guy. So tell us about your political journey leading up to how you ended up at the NPI conference.
Yeah, so about a decade ago, I was interested in philosophy and economics, and was reading a lot of the classical liberal thinkers at the time, and eventually got interested in Austrian economics. I'm guessing like a lot of fellow alt-righters. Yeah. And so, you know, I was reading Mises, keeping up with the Mises Institute. And, you know, while I studied economics as my major, and while I still think they're right about a lot of things when it comes to just economics, my views kind of shifted eventually insofar as I see social relations as being more important politically than economic relations. And that's something that a lot of libertarians just don't address at all. There are non-economic values. And so, you know, I went from the Mises Institute to reading, you know, some of the Dark Enlightenment thinkers and neo-reactionaries, and eventually became an alt-righter once I was exposed to the JQ, and it's been no looking back since.
That's how it goes. So what did you think about the alt-right conference and the whole, you know, Heil fiasco as seen in the media across the world?
I think it was great. I mean, there's no way to get media attention without some Nazi LARPing. You know, I think this approach is what George Lincoln Rockwell took. You know, nobody paid attention to him until he started wearing a swastika armband. So, yeah, I mean, I made the alt-right, made Spencer a household name, or, you know, helped in that trajectory. So, all in all, a great thing.
It's funny, too, because, you know, we knew a couple of those people and we know them. They're having fun. They were having a good time. They're letting loose. Mm-hmm. We've said this many times, but it's like a middle finger to the establishment. It gets people so worked up doing that salute. And as we can see, it does work. It does get attention. It's funny.
Definitely.
Well, so you're very clued into the alt-right, pro-white, whatever you want to call it, movement. But what are your thoughts about it? And you can say anything, the good and the bad. So don't be shy.
Right. I think it's a necessary move in the Western world to for like a white identity to kind of to be valued. You know, I think about Brazil and India and how, you know, the fertility rates of non-whites are consistently higher than the fertility rates of whites. And, you know, once you're living in a non-white nation where minorities or non-whites are the majority, it turns into a shithole.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like America is maybe 50 years from being Brazil and, you know, 200 to 300 years from looking like India. And I hope that doesn't happen. India is a hellhole.
You know, I've been saying this a lot, but it's bad when even, you know, non-Europeans are telling Europeans that, you know, miscegenation and blending out is going to make Western civilization, you know, a horrible place. You know, it's like other people are seeing it before our own Europeans are seeing it. And of course, we get a massive amount of propaganda blasted at us that we should, you know, race mix to end whiteness for world peace, which is rubbish, of course. But yeah, so if whites were to blend themselves out until no whites were left, do you think it would just turn into Brazil, right?
Oh, I think much worse. I think it would turn into turn into India. It's interesting. The caste system in Hinduism, it arose primarily, I think, to preserve racial purity. That the castes have been endogamous for, you know, a few thousand years now, and, you know, it was just a little too late. And, you know, just a little bit of minority admixture and, you know, compounded generation after generation. I mean, look at Egypt. They're a lot whiter way back when, and it doesn't help any group to lose their European bloodlines.
Yeah. Yeah.
To dilute them. Yeah. I mean, psychometric data is pretty clear on who's smarter and who's not. You know, it's pretty clear which civilizations advance further than others. I mean, you know, if Europeans got to calculus before Sub-Saharans got to the wheel, then perhaps we can read something into that.
Now, you mentioned the Indian caste system. So tell us a little more of that. Is that still very much in play today? Is it basically, you know, people are trying to marry within their class, or how does it work?
So there's, I mean, the broad outline, there's five castes, but it ends up being divided like racially, regionally, and then there's a bunch of subcastes. I think Carlton Kuhn, I believe, tried to do some research in it, and he just gave up because, you know, there ends up being, you know, thousands of castes. You know, I'm really only aware of a small branch of, you know, a handful of subcastes of the Kshatriya, the warrior caste that's dominant in Punjab. And even then, I know a handful, but yes, they don't mix at all. There's strict, very strict assortative mating with these castes. And even within my religion, I was born and raised a Sikh, and, you know, our gurus tried to abolish the caste system. And, despite that, we're more like Europeans about it. It's like, we don't have an official caste system, except we only marry people of our own socioeconomic status. You know, it's just not official. But
so in your case, how did they know that your family, that you come from Sikhs, or how did they know who's a Brahmin? How do they decide that?
So it's done by last name. It's also like distinct physical features. I mean, I'm not really good at telling different types of Orientals apart in the same way Orientals are. But like with different Indian groups, I can look at one guy and say he's from Gujarat, and another guy and say he's a Tamil Brahmin, and another guy and say he's an untouchable, intuitively, just because, you know, I don't know, genetic proximity perhaps, or, you know, in a way that you're probably going to be better at telling Europeans apart than I am. So, it's that, it's looks, it's last name, it's wealth, Your whole social standing in Indian society is effectively based off of that.
Now, do you guys have the equivalent of SJWs in India who are attacking this caste system as being something racist that we have to put an end to?
There is. It looks like, it looks like any time the intellectual elites of, you know, I see the Indian intellectual elites come into the U.S. and the ones that go into the humanities or go to Ivy League schools become social justice types. And it's disgusting. I mean, I've seen Sikhs who are cucking for Islam, and it's like, this is so far, you know, it's very contrary to our religion and our, you know, our historical tradition. But, you know, they go to Harvard and then they want to stop Islamophobia. I think, you know, the role of Sikhs, we should try to raise Islamophobia personally. But, you know, there was a Gurdwara, a Sikh temple, shot up a few years ago by, they said, by a neo-Nazi. And And yeah, all these left-wing Sikhs started saying, well, we need to raise awareness about how Muslims aren't bad. And it's like, nope, we need to direct them at the right target. We don't want to associate ourselves with these people. That's the other thing is, Punjab, the Muslims are doing the same thing there that they are here. They come in, they rape, they murder.
I bet they see the women in their saris in contrast to the burqa, and they just can't help themselves, right? Because the sari is much more sensual than the burqa look.
Definitely.
Yeah. Generally, when people think of India, they think Hinduism. But mm-hmm. Islam is a big force in India. So tell us about that. I mean, how big is it?
This is the horrifying thing is within our lifetimes, India will be there will be a Muslim majority in India. And, that's something that gets to me every day. My ancestors fought the Mughal emperors, the Islamic invasion of India a few hundred years ago. That's why my religion arose. And, now the Muslims there, they have higher fertility rates. They are quicker to convert people. And it's disgusting. It will be, I think, another 20 years or so, and it's going to be more than half of India.
So do you think that's just alarming. That's shocking. I had no idea. But thinking in terms of the birth rate, so Indian women now that they're in the workforce, they're going to school, they're having less kids, right? Is that what's happening?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of the same dysgenic trends that we're seeing in the West. The women who go to graduate school, or, the smart girls who go to graduate school, they don't have kids. I have a couple cousins who are, they're professors now, and these girls are, they're not married at 31, 32. And, that's by Indian standards, way older than, like the expected age of marriage is a lot lower in India for girls than it is in the Western world. And so at 32, their chances of getting married or having kids are slim to none. Meanwhile, the untouchables, the Dalits are having, half a dozen babies each or something. I mean, perhaps that's a exaggeration, but they're outproducing, the people who should be reproducing. So
I also see a trend of a lot of Indian women who, like Kushama Sawant, I don't know if you've heard of her. She sits on the Seattle City Council. She's runs a socialist alternative. The press loves her. They talk about her all the time. She's from India. She comes here, she goes to school, and then it's, feminist this and, social justice that, and just left and right. And I've seen a lot of Indian women come to our schools, and then they come out talking like this. You see it in Canada, you see it in America, you see it in the UK. I mean, it's awful. I mean, but do you have some of that there? Do you have some women that are talking about social justice and feminism and stuff in India?
They're a lot... They're picking up feminism, but they're not as degenerate with it as the West, or they're not as far along on the feminist agenda as
maybe it's because
the
there's so
world.
Many Muslims there.
right. But I think it's interesting that you bring that up. I think that even people who are naturally inclined to being conservatives. Once they're removed from the soil, once they leave their nations and they become rootless cosmopolitans, they pick up the political inclinations of rootless cosmopolitans. They become more like Jews. Yeah, I mean the Sikhs for social justice are the ones that that's the biggest example that comes to mind right now.
I had no idea that was a thing, really.
Yeah, I don't like to associate myself with them, but.
So give us some insight then into the parallels between the alt-right movement and Sikhism.
It arose as an Indo-European militant response to the Islamic invasion of India. Islam, as you and probably most of the listeners know, it spreads by the sword. And so the Mughal Empire comes down to India, and, it's convert or die for everybody. And the Sikh faith, I mean, it's not, in some sense, it's not really even a religion, at least by Western standards. It's a military cult that eventually started LARPing as a religion. I mean, we have our turbans and beards, but that's more of a military uniform. We supposed to carry around a gerban on us. That's a sword, a Sikh sword that we supposed to carry around on us as part of our religion. But it's not for symbolic purposes. It's because there might be Muslims nearby. And, you know, while we won a few hundred years ago, it's, you know, as the Sikhs become more deracinated, as they leave Punjab and go to the Western world, you see Islam spreading again in India. And I think the alt-right is a lot like Sikhism insofar as it's a response to the spread of a foreign tradition.
So is India doing anything to push back against it? Are your politicians doing anything? Are people doing anything to push it back against Islam taking over India?
Yeah, so I'm a fan of the current prime minister. I forget his name, sorry. But he, you know, he was the former governor of, I believe, Gujarat. And there was a genocide of Muslims going on in Gujarat, and he was famous for kind of looking the other way or not having the state interfere with that. And magically, you know, Gujarat went from being, you know, one of the high crime areas with you know, not terribly wealthy to becoming a low crime area and one of the more successful cities in India. And, you know, unsurprisingly, because, well, you remove a problem and you're kind of good to go. So, you know, he's the prime minister right now. And I hope he continues to look the other way as the natives respond as they should.
Now, is India actually multicultural? I mean, when I was there, it's not multiracial, but you do have multicultural elements. So explain that.
I mean, I think to a certain degree, the human biodiversity in India is something that's often overlooked. I don't consider myself part of the same racial category as you know, many South Indians, for example, the kind of the very dark, short ones who, you know, are the ones that typically defecate in the streets. And
I have to tell a story. When I was on the train one morning going in India, I saw a whole field of men squatting and defecating together, talking, yeah, just chatting, yeah, just doing their thing, chatting, squatting, taking a poop.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I mean, I remember visiting when I was in the first grade or visiting India, and you know, a lot of my family lives in the capital there. And you know, I step outside and I see these three nice old ladies walking down the street, and it's kind of like a Golden Girls situation. It's like, oh, that they seem nice, and they all pop a squat together, no shame at all, and just start going in the streets. And that's when I became red pilled right there. I was about 6 years old. And
oh, that's funny. Yep. Yeah, but it does amaze me though. These women, they manage to be able to stay so lovely in their saris and look pretty clean when the streets are pretty dirty in some places. I was impressed by that.
I saw some numbers from the UN, and it seems to be the case that more than half of India is not potty trained.
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean it. I think it's legitimately easier to potty train a dog than it is most of the natives there. I mean, it's. Yeah, they're
so plumbing's out of the question. That's why when it rains, everyone's like, "Get out of the street!" Right?
Right. Well, it's worse than that. I mean, they're trying to incentivize. There was a Mr. Pooh campaign going on there to try to like promote, like you know, I guess.
Yeah, how to dispose of your shit properly, basically.
Yeah, even getting to the point where they subsidize people to, you know, use toilets. And it's not working.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And then there, you have the complete opposite. You know, when I stayed in India for a few weeks, we stayed with some Brahmins, and they were entirely a different human compared to, you know, the folks that we're talking about here. And they also, they ate meat. They weren't vegetarians.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, certain types of Brahmins. Depends, I guess, on which Brahmins from which area. But yes, they're in general, I mean, they're the high IQ group. Them and Kshatriyas. I think a lot of like Tamil Brahmins, and I think they kind of end up being kind of Jewy personally. Mm. Like they're high IQ, but they're not ones to, you know, join the military or do any actual productive labor, any farming, anything like
that. Paper pushers, intellectuals, yep. Yeah. But let's take it way back. I want to know, you know, I've heard different things about the Aryan invasion theory and, of course, the early civilization in the Indus Valley and the Indo-European connection. What can you tell us about the Aryan invasion?
Right. So it looks like there were a couple different invasions that hit India. And looks like the Persians early on, forget the year, but yes, the... I think the Scythians also came to India. And thing is, like, unlike other places where conquerors go, they, you know, they usually, like, the Vikings would go somewhere, they'd conquer, they'd kind of rebuild the conquered civilization, and then they'd come back every year to collect taxes, something along those lines. The Aryan invasion of India, they just kind of got there and effectively settled down. And so I believe it's Razib Khan. He's done some research on the genetic the amounts of admixture of different groups and various different Indian races. And there's good reason to believe that there's a decent amount of like Persian and European admixture in Northwest Indians, Kashmiris, Punjabis primarily. And the further you go down south, the darker people get, the smaller people get, the less potty trained people get. And it seems like the natives were effectively proto-Australoids. You know, if you compare side by side North Indian and South Indian, I mean, the native South Indian untouchables, they look darker than a lot of sub-Saharans. Yeah, and meanwhile in Punjab, I mean, my grandmother was a ginger. I have cousins with blue eyes. I have a lot of Sikhs I know that are paler than a lot of Europeans I know, or, you know, have that, like, maybe like Italian level skin complexion, something like that.
Yeah, well, there's different theories. So for people who don't know, Aryan invasion theory, that it goes that India was basically, you know, invaded or conquered by a nomadic light-skinned kind of Indo-European tribes. They claim mm-hmm. from Central Asia around 1500 BC, and they overthrew yep. an earlier darker-skinned Dravidian, I think, civilization.
Yes.
Which is funny, though, that they say from Asia, because, of course, we have the Tarim Basin Caucasian mummies, right, in mm-hmm. present-day China. And this was about 1800 BCE, and there were gingers and blondes. Huh. And so that might be some of the influence there in your bloodline. And I know China yeah. has tried to cover up the Tarim Basin Caucasian yes. mummies. I don't want to talk about that.
Yes, it's, I mean, it's remarkable how much the, when you look into, you know, different nations and their ancient histories. And I mean, you see giant swastikas, you know, appearing in South America that predate the Native Americans coming, or the, you know, the Amerindian populations, you know, coming to the Americas. It's tying into the Aryan theory. I mean, it's theorized that Hinduism is effectively a brand of European paganism.
Yeah.
And I mean, we see parallels or between like Latin and Sanskrit. I mean, they're both Indo-European languages that stem from a similar proto-language or mother language, whatever you want to call it.
Now, are you pretty well versed in the Vedas?
Not so much. I mean, I'm a lot more well versed in, the Sikh scripture.
Now, how does that differ?
Not too much. And so the Sikhs were a monotheistic religion. I mean, being the whitest group in India, they had a lot of, traditionally European impulses. They had this kind of egalitarian impulse. So they got rid of, at least within our religion, we got rid of sati, which is basically the burning of widows. Like they'll burn the widow's body on top of the corpse of her dead husband while he's being at his funeral. And so the Sikhs got rid of that.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me of a Viking tradition, actually, when the man was burning on the funeral pyre with all his things. Sometimes she would jump on there to go with him to Valhalla.
Oh, I had no idea that was a Viking tradition. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, so there's that. I mean, part of what you'll see with Sikhs is that, most of their last names for the males will be Singh, which means lion, and the last name of women will be Kaur, which means princess. And it was an attempt to get rid of the caste system, although we all practice it, but it was an attempt to get rid of the caste system, and by women not adopting the last names of males, it's kind of more, I don't know, sexually egalitarian too.
Mm.
So the scripture is, it's basically it's a monotheistic religion. The God is fairly uninvolved God. Like our gurus, there was no miracles performed or anything like that, or claimed. There's no supernatural powers attributed to them. The God is an immanent God rather than a transcendent God. So it's kind of a lot like pantheism or deism.
Getting back to those swastikas, a lot of people don't know that there's swastikas found all over India. So what do you guys know about that down there? Do you guys ever talk about it? Do people ever bring up Hitler and, hey, he used that symbol too? Or how does it work down there?
Oh, no, there's not really the same type of, Western virtue signaling going on with that. So you'll see, I'll see a lot of people wear jewelry with swastikas on it when I visit. They're not apologetic about it at all. And I mean, with Hitler, I have a big poster of Hitler in my room, and my father saw it for the first time the other day when walking into seeing my room, and he didn't bat an eye. Oh, nice picture. there's no like, oh, oy vey, that's Hitler. You shouldn't have that. There's none of that going on.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Your dad sounds like a open-minded guy then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no Holocaust programming in India? Not yet.
Oh,
anyway,
not yet. Although it's going in that direction. I mean, there's recent Bollywood movies trying to not yet normalize homosexuality, but at least frown on like homophobia, that sort of thing. And I mean, like my grandfather is a painter, and he was complaining, last I talked to him, he was complaining about the Jews taking over all the art galleries in India and how they won't buy his, take in his paintings anymore because
it's not degenerate enough.
Yeah, I mean, they want paint splatters, and they prefer paint splatters to actual, technically skilled real art.
Now, are there Jewish Indians, or where are the Jews coming from that are in India?
It seems like they are ones to kind of hedge their bets or, diversify their portfolio, right?
They blend in, they mix in.
Yeah, the Rothschilds, they've married into Sikh royalty, effectively.
Really?
I was talking to a buddy of mine, and he was saying that, his neighbor was bragging about how his daughter married a Nigerian prince, and I mean, it just seems like they marry into the elites of every civilization. Yeah,
just in case, right? Just in case.
Just in case.
So we can be top dogs there too, or there, or pretty, there, or there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, why do you think Hitler was so interested in the Vedas? I haven't looked into that enough, and maybe you can tell us.
I mean, I'd imagine, I'm just taking a guess here. I don't know too much about that, but I'm guessing just a generic, you know, it seems like there's a big tradition of Orientalism in the German, you know, Germans, a lot of them are Orientalists, and he's probably interested in the how it relates to the European pagan tradition. That and, you know, there were a lot of, you know, there was the Free India Legion. There were a bunch of Sikhs who ended up fighting for the Führer, or a lot of Indian nationalists that tried to, instead of siding with the Brits, siding with Germany there.
Wasn't Gandhi also writing letters to Hitler?
Yes, I believe that's one of the few things that Gandhi did write. It's something that drives me up a wall in the Western education system. The story we're told, that I was told in school, is that, the Brits came down to India and they just ruined everything, and they tore down this glorious nation and they made everybody poor. And then Gandhi, he went on a diet, and that he drove away the Brits through his peace powers or some bullshit you know, and it's just absolute nonsense. The British Empire was glorious, and it helped India in every possible way. You know, you see birth, you know, infant mortality rates go down, standards of living go up, an unprecedented amount of economic growth, lifespans go up. You know, we have exposure to the Western tradition, and, you know, they build universities and railroads and hospitals and all this great stuff. And the reason why they left is because the world wars were really expensive and they couldn't afford to subsidize India anymore. Yeah. You know, there's this notion, oh, well, the British Empire, they got rich because they went to all these other places and robbed them blind. You know, it's so dumb. I mean, you don't get rich by trying to rob a homeless person. That's just not how it works, you know?
Yeah, and further, they were investing quite a bit to build up these infrastructures, and they actually gave a lot. So basically what we're saying here is colonialism actually helped India, right? That's what we're saying here.
I am part of the India Dependence Party. My dream is that one day the Brits come back and make India great again.
Yeah, I mean, when I was there, I saw some train stations and other buildings that the British built that are still standing, that are still in use.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the other thing about Gandhi. He wanted to tear down everything that the Brits built. He wanted India to be a socialist autarky that doesn't trade with the West and like ignores all of Western influence and goes back to stupid Indian practices. And how much he's lionized in the West today should be indicative of how awful he must have been.
So let's talk about that then. During imperialism, British imperialism in India, was there a cooperation with the locals? I mean, there would have to be, because, you know, it's not like the Brits were flooding over there by the millions, were they?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of cooperation. And I mean, I know a lot of people in my family were huge, huge fans of the British Empire. They're, you know, things that they took pride in being, you know, civil servants for the British. And I mean, one of the things that the Brits were doing actually they were using Indians to help colonize Africa, because Indians are effectively malaria proof in a way that Brits aren't, due to the high parasitic load and the hot climate of India, right? And yeah, so I mean, I had a lot of family that was raised in, or that got, you know, they moved to Kenya to help build up Kenya for the Brits. So yeah, definitely a lot of cooperation. And, you know, not everybody, at least back then, was against the British influence in India.
Now, do you know what kind of numbers were down there at this time? How many English people were actually in India? Because I know a lot of people would come and visit, but not very many stayed and lived, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they'd have to be morons to stay there. you know, I believe Rudyard Kipling went down for a few months, too. And then he went back. He didn't really think too highly of the Indian tradition, and fair enough. But yeah, I don't think too many stayed.
Now, and today, thinking in terms of the young people, I don't know what kind of programming they're getting, but are they told horror stories about colonialism and when the English were here?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. When I'd visit in the past, it would be in the summer, and anytime there's, they're practicing or they're celebrating their Independence Day, there's all these movies about these, the evil Brits oppressing the native Indians. And, I distinctly remember watching one when I was younger, and one of the insults, and I kid you not, one of the insults that the Indians in the movie were using against the Brits were, oh, those Brits are so silly, they wipe their ass with paper. What do you guys shower with paper too? Yes, you silly people. And because, yeah, I mean, this is something that the few Indians who are potty trained, they don't use toilet paper. They use their left hand.
Yes.
And then they, soap isn't available everywhere. So just be careful about whose hand you shake.
Okay, so there's a bunch of people there now that are like, when the Brits came, and now there's a lot of Indians going to the UK, flooding the UK, and it's quickly becoming.
Yeah,
so what do you think about that?
Oh, I mean, it's horrific. From what I understand, there's a lot of Sikhs, way too many Sikhs in London. I mean, Punjabi is becoming the second language there, and as a Punjabi person, that's horrifying. No, they all need to be deported. They need to get back to India. They need to start implementing some eugenic policies, both negative eugenic policies and positive eugenic policies, insofar as, discouraging the Untermensch from breeding and encouraging higher reproductive rates for the higher caste, higher class people. But instead, no, they're leaving their homelands and going to becoming rootless cosmopolitans in the West. This is something I've been thinking about for a while. A lot of people I see in the alt-right or alt-light, at least, they'll complain about more obviously problematic minorities, right? So the ones who are raping and murdering and that sort of thing. But they'll kind of cuck when it comes to the high IQ, high achieving minorities. And I think they're misled when they do this. Even if you're looking at in the US, if you're looking at Orientals or, the high IQ Indians here, and even if these minority groups have a lower crime rate and higher socioeconomic status and more education and yada yada yada, I think in many ways are more problematic than the minorities who are raping and murdering people, insofar as they are destroying social capital. One of the ways they get ahead in the West is by monetizing on the destruction of social capital. An example comes to mind. I was hanging out with some of my Oriental friends, and they were telling me about how they're doing this thing. This is a couple of years ago. They're doing this thing where they get a credit card, they get on some rewards program where they get some cash back on all their purchases, right? And they'll go to Nordstrom, a store, a very high trust store that caters to, upper middle class whites primarily. Now, because Nordstrom caters to upper middle class whites, it's a very high trust thing. They have a very lenient return policy. So what these Orientals and Indians would do is they'll go to Nordstrom, they'll charge their card for like $10,000 worth of stuff.
Jeez.
You know, and $20,000 worth of stuff in one day. They'll wear those things, whatever they buy, they'll wear it that week, and at the end of the week, they'll return all that stuff for full credit back on their credit card.
Jeez. Or,
you know, they'll work it in some system such that they'll get it credited back to their account. However, they still get the rewards points for whatever money they spent
oh,
there.
Oh, that's dirty. Cheap and dirty.
Cheap. And I mean, that sort of thing is just, that's just one of dozens of examples that come to mind. I mean, I worked in investment banking in the past, and I remember different departments of within the company I was working for. You know, if you would always see this kind of, if the manager of one department is a Nigerian Igbo, the majority of the people hired in that department are of his tribe.
Of course.
You know, and then you see the one department is Jewish. Well, most departments are Jewish, but it always ends up being the case. Like, except it was the case except for the department that had the white managers. The departments that had the white managers, they hired meritocratically, and so they hired
one of each. Right.
One of each. Whereas everybody else, they're not practicing that same policy. And in some sense, positive attributes of these market dominant minorities, like, oh, they have a lot of group solidarity, that's a great thing. Well, it ends up being at the detriment of the local population.
Yeah.
You know, when I go to Gurdwara, for example, when I go to the Sikh temple, for example, everybody there, if you want a job, you just talk to somebody there and they'll get you in. And it's not based off of them thinking that you're more credentialed than others. It's them being co-ethnics. So yes, they'll hire based off of their tribe. Meanwhile, the locals aren't, and you know, they'll take advantage of social safety nets. So anything with insurance, they'll take advantage of.
They're abusing our high trust society, basically, and they're also using their diversity status to get ahead. But at what point does that end? I mean, because there's some towns where whites aren't the majority. And further, what is the population of India? Isn't it 1 billion people now? I mean, that's hardly minority status.
Right, right. It's more than 1 billion at this point, I believe, and it's gonna have a larger population than China within, you know, another decade or so, from what I understand, at current rates.
Yeah, the Chinese is another one that people don't seem to see, but they're now in America starting to surpass Latinos and when it comes to immigration. And then, of course, they have birth tourism, and there's so many of them, and they're coming over here. They're taking over Canada, but they're quiet about it. They're not protesting in the streets and whining about things. And then all of a sudden you come to a town, it's like, whoa, it's all Chinese here. You know, people are joking around about Vancouver, calling it Hongcouver, because it's just like all Chinese now. I mean, so it's true. We tend to kind of ignore the high IQ populations, but that they're equally as dangerous, maybe even more dangerous, because they're smart and more cunning. And the Chinese, I mean, they'll think of ways to just full on just take over.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, just thinking back to high school, I mean, the Orientals, it's funny, the cafeteria is kind of racially segregated, but like everybody kind of still, at least, you know, the black table might have a few whites that kind of are into the rap culture or whatever. And everybody kind of mixes. And then there's the Oriental table, and it's only Asians.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's only Chinese, like no Koreans allowed type.
Yeah, exactly. Type thing,
you know, and they would have, you know, in homeroom every morning, they'd have a circuit where they'd, you know, one Asian does the history homework, one Asian does the math homework, one Asian does the science homework, and they'd all switch copy.
They're like, they're ants, robots, right? They're like,
yeah. They just, I mean, the amount that they cheated is insane. I mean, I knew a couple that, you know, given how similar they look, they would they would pay each other to take, you know, standardized exams, you know, like SATs and ACTs. So, you know, they take the highest score of each section when you take the SATs each time, right? So since there are three sections, a lot of them would take it three times. They'd either study for each, you know, each section separately, or they'd, you know, pay one of their friends. You know, if one Asian has a really good verbal score, they'll pay him a couple $100 to go take the SATs for him.
Oh, jeez.
You know, there's a calculator program on the TI-83 where you have a search function where they would input a database of all the SAT words into their calculator. So when they're working on the math section, on the scratch paper that they have, when they get to the reading section, they'll write down the words that they didn't know. And when they get to the math section, they'll look it up in their calculator.
Mm.
And then they'll go back and bubble it in. I mean, there's so many just shady things like that that are standard practice for these people. It's disgusting.
How did you find out about it?
Well, I mean, a lot of my friends were doing it too.
So that was funny. Yeah,
I'm not exactly guilt free in everything there. I mean,
well, you'd think that some of these teachers are finding out about some of this, or is it racist to point that out?
It's racist, but you know, these high IQ minorities are a lot smarter. They're a lot more cunning and good about hiding it than people believe.
Yeah, exactly. So that's more of a dangerous threat than the, you know, loudmouth shouting, protesting on the street. That's the devil you know. You should be worried about the devil you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, so the example I brought up before with the Nordstrom return policy, I mean, it's going to be all the people who it's going to be all the people who don't, you know, practice these shady practices that they're going to end up subsidizing. Like the prices that Nordstrom has to charge people are going to go up because certain people are abusing the system. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be the whites that they're taking advantage of. It's going to be the whites that end up paying for that. And that happens everywhere. And when it happens so much with basically every activity that these minorities do, I don't think it's reflective of their merit. When I see the socioeconomic status of a Chinese person or an Indian being significantly higher, like, you know, average household income being higher than the native whites, it's not because of their high IQ. I very strongly doubt that.
Then what is it?
Oh, it's just they're cheating. It's them not just destroying capital, but profiting off of the destruction of social capital.
This is awful. It's, you know, exactly. No good deed goes unpunished. And it seems like the white man is just constantly punished for like having a heart, basically, you know, being compassionate.
Yeah. Oh, pretty much. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Indians that are leaving. You know, I've kind of heard that it's the best and then some of the worst. So who's leaving India and why?
So a lot of these big tech companies will go to India and go to the top universities there and basically hand H-1B visas to all the top graduates, bring them to the U.S. and kind of have them work at a lower wage than they would pay the natives. And, you know, so from what I understand, first-generation Indians in the U.S., at least like a decade or two ago, when they did some psychometric research on like what is the IQ of an Indian in America, and I believe it's like right up there with the Ashkenazi Jews in America, or perhaps even higher, or at least it was. But, you know, then regression to the mean hits, and, you know, some of the smart Indians who come here, they get their green cards and they sponsor their stupid cousins to come over, and, you know, it doesn't last, you know, them the smart ones being here, it doesn't last that it's only the smart ones. Not that the smart ones are good for the nation as it is, but they start. Yeah,
it's amazing. Indians are working everywhere, all the call centers. I mean, there must be tons of call centers in India now. And then freelancer.com. I went on there to have some work done on one of my websites, and it's just tons of people from India on there. And now they're even being imported in. That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. And
these capitalists, you know, don't care. They'll use them.
Well, what's alarming is a lot of the Indians or Orientals who get their green cards, what they'll do is they'll start up consulting companies or IT staffing firms, right? So they'll find Indians who, you know, want an H-1B. They'll sponsor them for, you know, a couple thousand dollars, and, you know, they'll charge other firms. When larger corporations are hiring corp to corp, they can avoid, you know, paying the employee benefits if it's an hourly employee on a 1099. So they'll hire from these IT staffing firms that are primarily run by market dominant minorities, importing labor from their countries usually. And what these IT staffing firms do is, you know, they'll charge, let's say they charge Microsoft, you know, $70 an hour for the services of one of their programmers. They'll pay their actual programmer like $20 to $30 an hour. And so every person they staff, they take more than half of their salary. And, you know, it's like, oh, I wonder why they're so rich.
One of my favorites is, I don't know if you've heard of the YouTube channel, you guys should check it out, called Hoax Hotel. And this guy just records all these scammers calling him, like pretending to be the IRS and stuff. And a lot of them are from India. Thick Indian accent, trying to shake down like old people, scaring them into thinking it's the IRS. And they're like, they actually give money because they keep doing it. So obviously there's a bunch of suckers, God. You know, they're getting money from. Yeah, it's entertaining and kind of sad. Hoax Hotel, definitely check that out. So what is the biggest cultural differences, you think, between Europeans versus Indians in India?
It's kind of over the top as this sounds. It seems to be the case that, I don't know, I'm at the point where I believe that non-whites simply have fewer internal subjective states than whites. I mean, they don't have the same rich inner lives that Westerners do. They don't have a tradition, and, you know, they don't have a humanities. It's not very prominent there, like, you know, studying literature and philosophy and things that you can't monetize on. I mean, in terms of interest, they seem to have no non-monetary interests. Mm-hmm. And the big distinction I see is in a way that, like, in the Western world, in a high trust society, you know, it's kind of bound by this, you know, it's virtue signaling, right? So, you know, if you're in a society where people trust each other, it makes sense that people are going to kind of really socially ostracize or punish that one cheater, right? To discourage that sort of behavior. Now, I mean, once that virtue signaling is kind of hacked by hostile elites, then, you know, it turns into something else. It becomes, you know, vice signaling to a certain degree. You know, hey, I'm a cuck and I let guys bang my wife, you know, things like that. So Indians don't seem to have that. They have just straight up status signaling. It seems like the darker you are, the more loudly you signal your wealth. So, you know, if you're black, you'll dress like Kanye West if you get money.
Yeah, if you're a hood rat and you have nothing. Yeah.
Right, right. Whereas, like, if you're Indian, you know, I get on LinkedIn or I go on, you know, when I had a Facebook account, you know, I'd see whites and their profile pics would be them doing some charity work or something. So they could show, well, I'm a great person, right? and then I'd see the profile pictures of the Indians and it's them standing in front of their Mercedes Benz or them, you know, and it's very telling.
It's materialistic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very materialistic. That is funny. God. So, you know, the alt-right embraces ethno-nationalism, and we do this for all people, and this is true diversity. You understand this, you know. It enables each tribe of people to live as they want in harmony with each other without outside forces making demands, you know, with all the cries of racism and discrimination and supremacy. Really, we offer the solution. It's really easy. Each of these people should just have their own country. Problem solved. But, you know, most non-whites, they have a country to go to that's all their own, but Europeans don't, and we're even losing our continent to hostile invaders, and we have to include everyone, as you said. But one day, I think these so-called minorities, you know, those living in European countries will be required to go back home. So do you think this is going to be beneficial to them in the long run for them to go back home?
Definitely. Well, in a sense, it will be good for their nations at the very least. Maybe in the short run, it won't immediately be to their benefit because they can no longer, you know, be parasites on the white man. but for their nations, I think it would be great.
Maybe not Nigeria, but we'll see about that.
Right. Yeah. Goodness. Well, that and if Western a lot of Western charities end up being counterproductive, you know, you giving money to sub-Saharans to an R selected people, they're just gonna procreate more, and you're gonna increase the amount of suffering. You know, this is.
Exactly. We're trying to end suffering. That's what people don't get about eugenics. They think it's something that's cruel and we just want to, you know, just murder people. No, it's actually trying to break the cycle of suffering and struggling and hardship, right?
Right, right. I mean, I'll joke around to kind of agree and amplify about, you know, how evil eugenicists are, like, oh, you know, it's great that there's an AIDS epidemic in these foreign nations, because at least something is keeping their populations in check. But no, you know, jokes aside, I mean, you're spot on. It will help everybody to just stop subsidizing poor people to have more kids, you know. And it doesn't need to be forceful. We don't need to go out there and you know, forcefully sterilize every mentally handicapped person and poor person. We can. You know, I had an idea the other day. I was thinking, you know, if I had $1 billion, I would go to every hood in America and I'd say, you know, take this pill. Whoever wants to take this sterilization pill, they get a free pair of Jordans. In fact, they get a, you know, 20 free pairs of Jordans.
That would probably work.
And honestly, like, even being not even being racist about it, you know, if whites want to take that deal, then they probably shouldn't be having kids either.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, you could subsidize people. I mean, I'm pretty sure if in India you told an untouchable that, hey, just take this pill that sterilizes you, and you know, you have a lifetime supply of food and curry or whatever the hell you want, you know, they'd take it. I mean, a lot of these untouchables, they will have kids simply to sell their kids into slavery. Jeez. Just for a few shekels.
I mean, is that still going on in India? I heard that there is child slavery and slavery.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, if you've watched the movie Slumdog Millionaire, one of the early scenes where, you know, when I'd go to New Delhi, I would see a lot of kids, you know, 5-6 years old on the sidewalk, and you know, one leg is cut off and both their eyes are gouged out, and like they've been physically handicapped by the people who have enslaved them simply to, you know, and basically to appeal to people's empathy so that they will, you know, donate money to these beggars. Yeah, God. And you know, it's a real buzzkill, because you know, it's tough seeing a 5-year-old hand, you know, you know, that you, and not giving him any shekels. And if you give him shekels, you're feeding into the problem. And yeah,
and the kid's not going to get the shekel anyway. It's going to go to his master.
Right. Yeah. It's disgusting. And yeah, we sterilize these people. This is no longer a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, you know, people want the AIDS epidemic to stop. People want, the Westerners want foreigners to stop dying of starvation. Simple, simple solution.
Exactly. I know people always say, well, Europeans are going down to, Africa and experimenting on them, all these medical things and vaccines that are killing them. And that's all bullshit. Actually, their population has exploded because we've been helping them with medical advancements and food. And it's just making it worse.
Yeah. It makes me think of Malthus, the economist who talked about overpopulation and a scarcity of resources leading to issues in the future. And he wrote it at the wrong time, because he wrote it right before the Industrial Revolution, where the world's population went up and everybody was wealthier. The issue is, there are certain types of people who can contribute. There's somebody invents genetically modified foods, and suddenly the entire species is that much richer for it. So if you have the right people procreating, if you have a population explosion of the right populations, then yes, you don't run out of resources. However, like with animals, Malthus is right, with animals or non-rational creatures, they'll spend the last of their marginal resources on procreation. So if you go to an area with that can support, that has a carrying capacity for 5,000 deers, but you put 10,000 units of deer food there, or enough food for 10,000 deers, that population will hit 10,000, and then it will constantly need that, that subsidy to maintain that population, right? And I mean, in some sense, that's basically what's happening in non-European countries. You give them some food, and they're just going to keep procreating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, what is it, gremlins?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, and that's the other thing, China, India, places like that, they stop being polite and caring for each other because there's so many of them. Like China, I've seen people get hit by a car and people just step over the body and keep going, like no one cares. It's just, ants on a line. That's what happens when the population is just so big, you stop caring. And you see that in New York too. People are assholes to each other a lot of the time. I think it's because there's so many people.
Oh, I would say because they're just genetically predisposed to having like lower, just less empathy than whites. I think even at a smaller population, they'd still be shitty to each other.
Too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I know we've been going for a while, but I wanted to ask you one last question. Tap that IQ of yours. How do you think we Europeans should deal with a lot of these leftists that are actively working against us to destroy us as a people and as a civilization? What are your thoughts?
I mean, my personal approach is just, using the fact that I have a turban to just kind of force them into addressing certain, just their cognitive dissonance and certain beliefs. So, trolling basically. And although I don't think whites should take that same approach, I think, just bullying these people. They don't respond to reason or arguments. So, just a hardcore black pill campaign of, I'm thinking the Goodbye America pictures. That is great. That's great propaganda for our side. If people on our side could afford it, we should just buy giant, billboards or giant poster boards on the highways or whatever with pictures like that. This is 1950s America. This is America today. I mean, it's very difficult to see that and not intuitively grasp that something bad is happening. But the other strategy, there's the agree and amplify. I've definitely been recommending this to my white friends, that they've obscured the lines between being a Spaniard and being Hispanic. It's just a cultural group now. It's not like a genetic category, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see what's her name from Gilmore Girls? The girl is like fully German, but I guess her parents are from Argentina. So she'll self-identify as a Latina and she'll get, you know, more. Yeah, she'll get more social credit for doing this. Well, you know, you're legally allowed. I mean, you could self-identify as Hispanic when you're applying to a job and they can't do anything about it. And they have Hispanic quotas to fulfill. So fuck it. Just say, you know, I sometimes put down I'm African American.
And it works. And then the question, yeah. you say, what? Are you yeah. doubting me? This is what I identify as. I mean, if a man can go and say, I identify as a woman, and you're not right. supposed to say anything, well, then I think a lot of these white guys should just go apply for jobs and just say, check the woman box, you know? And then if anyone doubts them, just be like, this is my gender. I'm gender fluid. Are you questioning me?
Yeah. I mean, I've actually looked into getting a legal sex change specifically for that reason. It's harder to do in some states than others. So in some states, you actually need to go through some sort of surgery or hormone therapy to get that legal status. But in a lot of states, it's pretty easy. You get a note from your therapist saying that, oh, I think I'm a chick now. So there you go. But with race, you know, race is a social construct, so you could claim to be anything now, right? So
except if you're Rachel Dolezal, right? Her life has been destroyed now.
Right, right. But you know, you just need to one up them on their lefty nonsense. So you know, all men originated from Africa, so what's niggas now.
Yeah,
know?
Exactly. What's the problem?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny. Well, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a lot of fun connecting with you and hearing your point of view and hearing a little bit about India, which is good, and what's going on there. So I really appreciate it. Is there anything else you wanted to share with everyone before we end for this time?
Nothing comes to mind. Thank you so much, Lana, for having me on. It's been an honor.
Before you go, our live TV show, Weekend Warrior, is on this Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 p.m. Central European Time. It's available to Red Ice members at redicemembers.com. You can log in and chat with fellow members during the show. We do release snippets of Weekend Warrior on our YouTube channel, so look out for those. Also, save the date, March 15th, as we'll be providing live coverage of the Dutch elections with our friends in the Netherlands. Lastly, I want to encourage everyone to stay positive and learn to laugh at the insanity that surrounds us. Humor can be your strength. If we don't learn to use it to our advantage, the obstacles that face us can feel soul-crushing. Humor works to normalize behavior. Look at how far Hollywood has been able to use their stupid sitcoms to normalize hating white people. It's why lefties are terrified when the alt-right uses funny memes and mocking jokes because they know it works to condition people. Well, we have all the good jokes now. One thing the alt-right seems to have with it is the spirit of chaos. Chaos in the good sense to break up the current order that is working against us. In mythology, chaos is the primordial soup, the void from which the gods and everything living arose. It's primal, raw energy before the state of creation. The name Red Ice was inspired by Gnungagap in Norse myth, the bottomless abyss that was there prior to the beginning of the cosmos. It tells how everything in the world came into existence in the gap between fire and ice. Red ice. Between the opposites. There will always be a left and right. Day and night, hot and cold, creative and destructive. In our current world, the friction sparking between two opposite forces, globalism and nationalism, or left and right, will force a new creation, a new order to emerge. All our small efforts combined help make this process happen. I think nationalism is an example of how balance and order in the universe may prevail and still have variation. In Norse belief, the world will relapse into forces of chaos, destroying the world until it once again may rise up and be renewed, cleansed from evil, where the sun will shine bright. The myth of Ragnarok says, one day the cosmos will collapse during Ragnarok, the twilight of the gods, and be reborn as the cycle completes itself. Join me next week for more 314 and, of course, Weekend Warrior every Saturday. Much love. We'll talk soon.